the forum topic tonight is human rights, and I'm pleased that the members of the Plowshare staff and advisory board are here again. We'll pick up with Alice Evans moderating the forum tonight. She is a research director at Plowshares, and I see that she has in hand the volume published on human rights by Orbis and put together by her husband, Robert, and herself, and it represents the first publishing project of Plowshares. So it's particularly appropriate that we get into this topic with these people. Alice?
Let me continue. Yeah, that's right. By the way, Larry is one of those who has written a marvelous blurb on this book. And again, a piece of the way that we seek to work together. Larry read the original drafts of this and suggested major revisions, which we followed. And
that's why you got the good blurb.
That's right. To continue with the introductions that were started by Bob last night, for the Advisory Council, you have met in different parts of today and yesterday the three before us. J.D. Otis Roberts, we said D. Otis has really given his all between, a 7 o'clock and Vespers and now.
Yeah. This is only his third thing since supper.
Diotis is at Interdenominational Theological Seminary in Atlanta. Bob Brown is at Pacific Lutheran. I'm sorry. School of religion, I repeat. Henry Wilson is on the faculty at the United Theological College in Bangalore, and Henry is also director of the Indian Board of Theological Education. His specific role to Plowshares is that Henry is the host and will be the resident director of the traveling seminar that Plowshares will take to India in January, and Henry may share some more about that. To put the discussion of human rights tonight into a framework and context, before each of these folks responds from his own perspective, I want to respond to some questions that I've had from a number at the table and so forth. One of those deals with these terms that we keep using, first, second, and third world, and the comment that came to me, well, isn't that terribly arrogant for us to assume that we are the first world and that there is a third world out there? Let me put that into the framework of the origin, or from what we know is the origin of these terms. Back in 1955, in Bangdun, Java, there was a conference of some 29 non-aligned nations. These were primarily Asian and African nations. At that conference, it was out of this group that this terminology first originated. They identified the first world as the capitalist, the primarily industrialized, for the most part, the members of the NATO alliance. This is the first world. The second world are the socialist countries of the world, predominantly socialist, predominantly Warsaw Pact, though clearly not limited to that. The third world they perceived and identified as those nations aligned in neither specifically the capitalist or the socialist camp. This is the part of the world that is referred to as the South in the North-South. The have-nots with the has. These are the powerless in the world. And I think it's important that we recognize that this terminology is not just limited to geographic boundaries, because we also speak of the third world in our own midst, of the poor, the powerless, the marginalized peoples of the world who do not have the power to control their destinies in the significant way that those of the first and second world do. The other intriguing thing is that that terminology is moving over and is increasingly referred to, they are referred to, or refer to themselves as the two-thirds world. For obvious reasons, if you go back to the global analogy of last night, dealing with population. There is also, our friends in the Pacific remind us, a part of the world that refers to itself as the fourth world. These are the Pacific Islanders, for the most part, and they say that they are so far out of it, so far beyond any sphere of influence, that they are not even part of the third world. Now, with those primarily first, second, and third world come an emphasis in the understanding of human rights. And let me try and be clear that it's not that a particular understanding of human rights is solely there. I want to talk in terms of emphasis. In the first world, when we speak of human rights, our priority and what immediately comes to our minds is individual civil and political rights. We talk in terms of the right, the freedom of speech, the right to own property, the right to a legal system that, that upholds the freedom of the individual. In the second world, here the emphasis and the focus is on communal and social rights. This is to say that the economic order must be such that all people have access to work, health, that there is a right to work, there is a right to health, there is a right to housing that puts it in the context of a very different emphasis that we're dealing with. To call back to Nancy's talk yesterday about People's Republic of China, she referred to a specific conversation with a young woman. This, I think, captures some of that emphasis on rights. The young woman said that it was clear that the state would choose where she worked. This leads in that context to significant employment across the board. However, in our country, we talk about the right to choose what you want to do. Now, this may be at the cost of unemployment, but the emphasis for us is on the freedom of the individual to choose what we want to do. In her context in China, this young woman said the state chooses because this addresses the needs of the broader social community. When these rights startle us, let me give you an example again of the emphasis in the first world and the emphasis in the second world. This also comes from China. There's a man named Ross Terrell at Harvard who has written a book called The China Difference. It's very important because it has helped me understand this focus, this emphasis. Terrell says that during the very terrible time of the Red Guards, when there was a massive emphasis on removing or ridding the country of all kinds of foreign influence, that in this kind of overstatement, there was an incident where a young man who was a pianist was playing Beethoven. He was reported, the guards came in and smashed his fingers. Those of us in the first world were absolutely horrified at this infringement on his individual rights. Almost at the same time, in the 70s, an elderly couple in New York City who did not have the money to pay a $20 gas bill froze to death in January. The Chinese, with enormous respect for the elderly, were horrified that this could happen in a country. That deals with the perspective that you take on which rights are most important, and all kinds of things about our governmental structure flow from that. The third world sees as its primary focus survival and liberation rights. Here we've got a massive part of the world that is suffering famine and drought, war, disease, and for them, they say that the right simply to survive must take priority over the other rights. The second part of that, in terms of liberation rights, is that these are for the most part, countries that have been under colonial rule for many years. And people in the third world are saying that they need a space here for themselves to be free of external pressures. One of the most intriguing ways to look at this came from Julius Nyerere, who is president of Tanzania, and a fascinating, extraordinary individual. He met for over an hour with the Plowshares group that was in Tanzania in January. And trying to help the group, dialogue with the group, he said, "You in America currently consume, statistics indicate, 40% of the world's resources. Right now, Northern Europe and this part of the world is working to increase their standard of living so that they are consuming 40% of the world's resources. The Soviet bloc is also struggling to raise their standards and so forth so that they are consuming 40%. Nyerere paused and said, "Do you see where this leaves us?" By not being a statistician, you can add up 40, 40, and 40 to the 100%.
You're
not even a statistician. And I think that there wasn't a balance. It was an overstatement. That the point is that from the third world perspective, most people in the third world, or a significant number, perceive both the first and the second world as manipulating and using their resources and becoming oppressive to them. And that is that sense of being non-aligned, focusing on survival and liberation. The last piece then brings me to the human rights book. And to give you some very brief background to this before we turn on to individual reflections on the issues of human rights. This came out of a marvelous grant to Bob and myself from the Mary Knoll Society. That was to take 2 years to literally travel and be and interview all over the world. We were in China, in Switzerland, in Southeast Asia, in Brazil, in Nicaragua, in Africa. Asking people in that part of the world what they perceived as the most significant issues of human rights that they were dealing with. We were astonished with the consensus that came from religious and political leaders about the significant issues they were dealing with. We were also intrigued with the parallels across the board, where in Australia they are dealing. Let you move into this because it will be available, but with the issue of land rights that the Aborigine and the Australian government are against, the same kind of issue comes up in another part of the world. A number of you have asked about how do I deal with the issue of Nicaragua in my local congregation. One of the cases, the introductory one, called To Bear Arms, is a story about Nicaragua. The most important thing probably to say about the eight stories, the eight cases, eight parts of the world that are brought together here, is that it is the story told from those persons' perspective. The story is from the perspective of a man who is a Pentecostal evangelical pastor in Nicaragua, struggling prior to the revolution with breaking his pacifist tradition. Does he join the guerrillas? But it presents us with his dilemma. Following the cases then are commentaries from both first and third world persons of differing perspectives. That was fun, but we find it a way, hopefully, that you can enter the issues of human rights of those persons involved. And it's important to say that when the cases were written, we returned them to the people who'd shared them. They revised, they said you didn't get it, or they said, yeah, you're getting the idea. That was part of that two-year process, was to turn it back to them. I leave that with you. Let me move, though, into the issue, because I know that Bob had said that he wanted to address the issue of Nicaragua. Out of that context, the one here is responded to, by the way, by Orlando Costas from a third world perspective, from a first world perspective by Johann Metz and Jürgen Moltmann. The one from Moltmann is particularly fascinating, but connecting the discussion this morning, he, as a young boy, was forced into being in the Nazi army. He became, as a result of this, an absolute pacifist. To hear him respond to the case in Nicaragua is a personal struggle, as I think, hopefully, as each of us wrestles with the issues, they must become personal struggles. In that light, let me turn it to Bob, and then we'll move around.
I've made two rather radical revisions in what I was going to say tonight because of events here. First is the reminder this morning that, or the reminder yesterday, that July 19th would be the fourth anniversary of the victory of the Sandinistas, who are now the government in Nicaragua. And then the information this morning that Nicaragua has been invaded through Honduras by an army of 10,000, supported basically by the United States of America, to try to overthrow that Sandinista government. And I think we have to look a little bit at what that says about our involvement in the rights or the lack of human rights in a place like Nicaragua. The second radical revision is one I've just made, because half of my speech Alice has already given very well, and I don't have to do that. This very important distinction we need to have in mind between individual human rights and social human rights. The only thing I would add to that good exposition is that I think in our culture we have tended to look upon the social rights, the right to a job, to a good education, to health care. In our culture, those have been privileges. That is to say, anybody in our society can get them if they can pay for them. And so you can get a neat education if you've got a lot of money, you can get marvelous health care, best surgeons around, you can get a good place to live if you've got the money for it, and so forth. And we had, of course, the beginnings of some attempt to guarantee those social human rights, and since the new administration came in, there has been, as you know, there have been concerted attempts to cut back on all that and once again get back to the place where those what are called the social human rights will once again assume the status of privileges for those who can pay for them. Now, we've only got a little bit of time, so let me just state my thesis out of this event, particularly the invasion this morning, very, very simply, and you can come back at this as much as you want. Let me try to be fairly provocative. I think we in the United States bear an enormous an unforgivable responsibility for the suppression of these social human rights and also even individual human rights all over Central America and through a good deal of Latin America and in the Philippines and in almost all parts of the world. Our track record is that we support the dictators. The ones who have the brutal and the repressive regimes are the ones who get the help from us. And when Vice President Bush last year and Secretary of State Schultz about 3 weeks ago can go to the Philippines and hail Marcos as a champion of human rights and the way America wants life to be lived, that to me is a shocking indictment of the insensitivity of our administration. In places where human rights, both individual and social, are flatly denied and people are killed, and Christians and priests and sisters and missionaries who take any stand in this are also killed, we have a big problem on our hands. Now, it seems to me that in the Nicaraguan situation, I'm sure you're aware that for 40 years, our government supported and kept in power the regime of the Somoza family. Over that 40-year period, there's a brutal record of terrible infringements, not only of the right to protest or to speak or to vote, but infringements of anything like rights for the poor to have minimal possibilities for education or health or jobs or anything of the sort. In the course of this time, this government, which could only maintain itself in power because of our military and political help, the family of the Somozas took to themselves so much land that when that family was finally overthrown in the revolution in 1979, if they had parceled out to the Campesinos, to the farmers, the land that was owned by the Somoza family alone, every Campesino in Nicaragua would have gotten 5 acres. That much in the hands of this one family. Those people didn't have the right to exist because they could not scratch out a living. If they ever engaged in any kind of protest over their plight, they were the victims of the police and the army and were executed. And we kept those people in power. Finally, there was enough outrage on the part of the Nicaraguans so that the Sandinista coalition grew up. Not just a bunch of Marxists, there was a Marxist component, but it has been a coalition of all kinds of groups who have been opposed to what Somoza represented. And 4 years ago today, they won that victory. They have had 4 years in power. What seems to me to, well, what has happened, that just seems to me, it's very clear, is that although at first the Carter regime was giving some support to that new Sandinista government, as soon as the present administration came in, not only was that support cut away, but any kind of loans, any kind of food shipments to this desperately poor country were cut off, and we began almost immediately what were first called the covert operations, which are now very clear, that we are not only refusing to give any support to that government, but we have been engaging in very active attempts to see that that government is overthrown. There is a law in our country that could not be done in the case of Nicaragua, and we have clearly been flouting that by keeping these operations so-called covert. Nobody knew about them for quite a while, and we have tried to maintain the fiction that all that the military advisors and so forth are doing there is trying to see that so-called supply lines of arms from Russia to Cuba to Nicaragua and Salvador are cut off. I don't think anybody in the administration is trying to maintain that fiction anymore. The clear intent is to overthrow the Nicaraguan government. Now, it seems to me that has a lot to do with human rights, because whatever your estimate of the Sandinistas, I think it's demonstrably true that in terms of human rights, their track record is incomparably better than Guatemala or El Salvador, to which we are giving very strong support. The government has not been without its flaws. There have been some suppressions of individual human rights, some instances for times, different times of some censorship of the press. The very, I think, ill-advised attempt to relocate the Miskito Indians from one place to another, the issue is not totally clean. But compared to the rights that those people now have in terms of the fact that the government has provided health care and education, the massive literacy program, which means that now the great majority of the people can read and write and now have some power and control over their own destinies. All these things, which are terrific pluses, our press, our State Department have tried to minimize, to twist around into negatives rather than positives, so that we have committed ourselves, our government has committed itself, to overthrow this government. We will certify, the President has certified, that there's been substantial progress in human rights in El Salvador, where, as you know, 2 years ago, the government murdered 14,000 citizens. Most of us only know they murdered three Roman Catholic sisters and a lay missionary. That's a terrible thing. And that helped to sensitize people in this country to the fact that what happened to those people whose names we know has been happening to thousands and thousands of people whose names we do not know. But since we want that junta, military junta in power, we certify that human rights are in good shape in El Salvador. And since we do not want the Sandinistas in power because they are a threat because of being part of a coalition that has the Marxist dimension in it and that represents an overthrow of a government we'd supported, we try to declare to everybody that human rights are in terrible shape in Nicaragua and we cannot possibly support a government like that. Well, I don't have much more time to go. The point I'm trying to make is that our nation is clearly involved in an attempt to destroy the possibilities that were presented by this new government in Nicaragua, and I think we have to take very seriously our complicity in that. But at the same time, we are supporting governments like the government of Rios Montt in Guatemala and the junta in El Salvador that have a shockingly bad record on human rights all over the scene. And we have skewed our priorities in some very terrible ways. And I think we have an obligation when we leave here to get in touch with our people in Congress and to deal with whatever kind of media of public impact we have through our churches and our church groups to see that this inversion of the concern for human rights somehow begins to be set straight. I'll leave it at that for now.
Thank you.
I think that I will try to deal with what my unique contribution might be to the discussion. Over against most Americans, black Americans have a different history, a different destiny. We're not native in the sense that the American Indians are. Neither are we migrants or people who have come from other countries willingly. We came in chains. And were enslaved for a long time, and that gives, I think, a different perspective on the subject that we have before us. Whether we're dealing with the problems that we have in human relations at home, or whether we have in mind those that we have discussed from abroad. And so it's from that experience, peculiar experience, that I think that I have some input and will concentrate on this narrow focus. I think that the black American, for example, cannot conceive of problems in the world apart from a direct relationship with the problems at home. And I think that is not negative. I think it can be very positive in the sense that whenever we think about massive human suffering in various countries of the world, and I had the opportunity early in my career to travel around the world and to look at the human condition. This broadened my perspective on the peculiar problems of my people. Therefore, when I was intensely drawn into the civil rights movement and also into the so-called Black Revolution in the late 60s, I had a universal vision of the human situation. For example, very early I came from the Far East into Calcutta, and I saw human misery and suffering on a scale I'd never seen in anywhere in the world. And this was a cultural shock. It was something that made me painfully aware of many problems at a deeper level. In other words, it did not in any way soften my concern for the problems which I knew existed at home, but it gave me a perspective which gave me some concern for the suffering of my human family. And that has been a part of my perspective, even though I've written a great deal on the black problem. As a theologian and ethicist, I've always been able to keep the perspective of how this links up with the entire human situation. So I have a great deal of appreciation for the concern for problems in other parts of the world. But I think it's a movement from the particular engagement with problems near at hand, first of all. And at the present time, I am intensely preoccupied with the political economy in the United States and the implications of this for the church and the way in which American civil religion has entered into complicity with a very conservative political and economic order in the United States that has brought to an end the liberal regime, of course, that Carter was the last representative in the White House of this particular effort of the Great Society. But I think it's very important that we realize the moral influence of our nation, not just the because of our political and economic clout, that what the position we take politically in the United States and socially in the United States on human rights has tremendous impact on what happens in the weaker nations, the powerless nations that depend upon us for political and economic support. And I think that the Black American has a peculiar mission at this point. In my involvement, for example, with persons in the third world, leadership in the third world, we were in dialogue with the West Indians, theological educators, some time ago. And we discovered that we had a delegation, an interracial delegation from Atlanta down in the Caribbean, in Jamaica, that we had differences based on race between blacks and whites that we needed to talk about in Atlanta rather than in Kingston. But we also discovered that we had differences with the blacks in Jamaica on the way in which we understood the gospel, certain ideological differences, certain psychological perspectives which we could bring to the discussion. For example, there is a kind of psychological neocolonialism in many of the countries, even though they are now in charge of their own destiny. They have their own political leadership. They may also be economically dependent on Britain, on the United States, and so forth, even though they have their political freedom, or at least partially so. And there has to be an awareness that they're not really free until they are psychologically free, until they're economically free. I find that, for example, in the Bahamas, that they are sustained by tourism, primarily from the United States and also from Western countries. And that even though they have their own prime minister, they have, for the most part, bought into the values of the United States, rugged individualism and capitalism and so forth, and the fact that the majority of the people are not getting the benefits of whatever prosperity that might be. In other words, the bad habits that we left in the colonial period in much of the world has become a part of the indigenized regime, that is, the political leadership has taken on the worst forms of oppression and classism that the British and, of course, many other European and American countries, including Canada, left in many parts of the world. So I see the possibility of Black Americans as having won a certain amount of self-affirmation, a sense of worth, and in a very difficult climate, and having won a certain amount of psychological freedom, of self-affirmation, people affirmation, especially in the last phase of the Black consciousness, Black power movement, a great transformation of consciousness, the fact that we used the word Black in reference to ourselves and gave it a new definition. In other words, it was not only a new use of semantics, it was a new self-understanding, a new affirmation of people, taking that which had a meaning that was negative and giving it a positive meaning, was a tremendous experience of psychological liberation. And this took place in all of our disciplines, not simply in theology, but in literature and the arts and so forth. So it was a tremendous experience of liberation. And we can share that as we link up with persons and peoples coming out of colonialism who are not yet psychologically free. And certainly because we have a tremendous intervention into the economy of this country in terms of billions of dollars of purchasing power, we have the tremendous possibility of using that as a leverage for increasing our freedom and, of course, helping to see how these economic benefits can be shared in the unprivileged parts of the world. But from a theological point of view, and from the point of view of the witness of the church, I want to use one illustration, a visit to Mexico and discussion with the theologians and church persons there. A little cell group met around the Bible study. And these were ex-priests, ex-nuns, ex-ministers. Very often when they really identified with the suffering of the people, they were put out of the church. They had to renounce their ordination. But in spite of that, they were willing to to understand the Bible in terms of the way a Bible addresses the liberation of the oppressed. And it was Duzel and I who had a very intense conversation. He's a historian of the liberation theology movement in exile, as it were, in Mexico. And we were trying to compare the impact of racism in the United States and the impact of poverty and so forth in his setting. And we were trying to come to some understanding as to how the experience of these two forms of oppression had similarity and had some impact upon people who victimized by them. And he drew a pyramid, and at the top of the pyramid were people like Andrew Young, or people who had really made it in the system. And at the base was the masses of unemployed, poor black people. That's where you conceive of racism as having its impact upon the United States. But I reminded him that even those who were at the apex of that pyramid were still linked in kinship and circumstantially with those who were at the base of the pyramid. But there's no way for us to separate ultimately the victimization from class in terms of economic status and class and racism, because they're linked in our experience. What we discovered then in that kind of discussion was that we had a whole lot in common, that we had a whole lot to say to each other, a whole lot to learn from each other. And that was a serious conversation, because in both instances, we were dealing with very serious forms of human oppression, powerlessness, and the gospel had somehow to be addressed to the liberation of those people who were oppressed. There was a Bible interpretation on the book of Jonah. And usually, biblicists and theologians give a very rarefied, transcendental kind of understanding of that experience, dealing with an understanding of God, whether God is transcendent or imminent, near at hand or far away, and so forth. But this interpreter tried to get us to understand that he was coming out of the experience of being in the belly of the whale. And what it must have been like for Jonah to have been in the belly of the whale, and the experience of nausea and entrapment and so forth that he must have experienced, and how he understood God from that experience in the belly of the whale. It gave a completely different interpretation to understand the gospel.
We want to give space, thanks, Curtis, to Henry, and also may want to respond to the image that Curtis has already raised of a radically different area of poverty that we're dealing with in India that we really can't conceive of in many ways.
I think since the movie of Gandhi is very popular, I thought I'll start with a quotation. And Gandhi once said, in this world we have so Gandhi made a statement that we have enough for everybody's need on this earth, but we don't have enough for everybody's greed. And he has taken it very seriously in his own life, and he said, this has to challenge my life. And those who have seen the movie, you may see when he saw a woman with barely having any clothes, he leaves out his upper cloth. And from that time, he refused to wear any upper cloth. He just put on a piece of cloth just to cover himself. And there's the incident. He goes to England to see the king, and he goes in the same dress. And the press report, I don't know whether it has been shown in the movie, but the press reporters were very upset, because at that time, going to see the king with I don't know how many, what dress they used to wear. And they asked, are you going to see king with this dress? Gandhi said, yes, because king is wearing enough clothes for both of us. Now, what we see when India, the problem with us, especially I'm talking to a Christian group, the problem is God wanted us, I put on another thing, I don't know who said this, love people and use things. But what we do today is we love things and use people. That is the, and that is the real problem which we are facing. And today we have become so much involved in going after these material things. They have really become human beings for us. Now going back to Gandhi, there's enough for everybody's need. Is there enough? I think many economists have made study, and today, as you know, there are 4 billion people. And they say in the earth we have enough resources, if we use it properly, to take care of 6 to 8 billion people without any difficulty. But the problem is proper use of it and proper distribution. And who are the people who are suffering? We stopped using the word third world because it becomes a little abstract. So we started using the word two-thirds of the world people, two-thirds of the people on this earth. They suffer hunger, disease, illiteracy, poverty, not because they are lazy, they are not willing to work, because of the system which we created. Now, often I wonder, see, we talk so much of Nazi persecution and 6 million Jews were killed. I am very sensitive to that. I feel very bad about that. And today we wonder how the churches and people didn't react to that. Not the whole, I mean, the good people react, but not why the church and other places didn't take this issue and saw that it didn't happen. But we are in the same situation. Actually, we are slowly putting to death, I think, 10 times more people than what a Nazi regime has done. And one day, I think by the time we finish the session, there are thousands of people who have died because we deprived them of their basic necessities, which would have given them life. And I think a generation after us, or a generation, 2 generations after us, they will ask the question, how come a civilization which has the best, I don't know, some technocrats believe that we reached in a way the peak, a civilization which had the best communication and has the lot of potentiality, just saw the two-thirds of people slowly perish. I think they will raise the question at that time, as we are raising the question against the Nazi regime. Now, the world situation is, in one place where people die out of malnutrition, hunger, disease, in other place we see in the affluent world people die because of overeating and create disease because they tamper with the nature and misuse the nature. So the greatest problem we see in the world is distribution. And this distribution is very well controlled. It's not just a problem in the affluent world, it's very much problem in the two-thirds of the world population. In our country, the rich control the economy and see that poor people are poor. And our rich and your rich collaborate in oppressing people. Today I want to tell you, many times people ask about this multinational corporation and their rich company. Please note this, they don't have allegiance to any country. Today, in the historical situation, US and the Western Europe suits for their operation. Tomorrow, if some other place comes, they will simply move. So our struggle is not just a struggle against one group against another. It is a struggle for the whole humanity, so the future will not experience the same kind of suffering which two-thirds of our population is struggling. Now, today, the biggest industry is arms and ammunition. And it is the affluent world which really controls. And there is so much of demand for arms and ammunition, a country like India has to book in 3 to 5 years in advance for tanks and for aircrafts or submarines. That means for next 5 years at least, and in case of some cases 10 years, arms and ammunition are turning out weapons. And this is going to be, many times you may think this is where may be going to be used in our country, but see, since global has become such a small thing, we are really supporting
something against our own destruction. So the monopoly, those who are the monopoly on arms and ammunition, they control. And for military equipment, we have to pay in hard currency, we say, either in dollars or Deutschmark or pounds. And we don't have that. So we have to see what we can sell to get that. So India looks at the affluent world and they need pepper or spices or some of our cash crop. So what we do, even though we convert our rice field to grow spices, it's not that our problem of hunger. India can grow enough food if it is allowed to grow rice and wheat and corn. But lot of our fields have to be converted to get cash crop which we can sell. And we don't get the price for price which will meet the cost. At least to give an example, we have to sell our sugar in the European market for less than what it costs us to produce it. And to balance or meet that cost, we Indians are charged more for sugar, so that we'll pay for our European brothers, I don't know whether sugar comes here, brothers and sisters, to get the sugar cheap. And in Africa, I read, in some places they have to convert their corn fields into growing flowers, especially roses, to export it to Europe to gain their hard currency. If you want, you can read in a book called Food for Thought, a document put forward by World Council of Churches. Now, can we simply change this? We cannot, because all this system is strongly guarded by a very well communication network and military force. Leaving the communist bloc, any country in the so-called free world, if it tries to tamper with this system, the whole government is thrown out. That is what the reference has been made, how US and other countries, they can even overthrow and change the government. And some of you may ask now, here is United Nations organization, aren't they doing something? They are trying their best. But you know how the veto power works. If you can study the UN documents, I think US and the Western power has used their veto power more than any other country did. And most of the cases, these are, if you go in a democracy, majority of the two-thirds of the world have voted for it, but is vetoed by these powers. I wish that some of you make a study. And also it is through UNO they have so-called gentlemen's agreement, that's how they call maybe. This gentlemen's agreement is, the wealthy nations, they give 2% of their gross net profit to the developing world. And you may be surprised, you may be thinking that a lot of money goes out of USA. USA hasn't met that target. Only Scandinavian countries are near it. And most of the 2% of the aid goes to their own respective priorities. Most of it goes to Israel or some other places. Now maybe to put down government in Nicaragua. And actually we found out in the world market we pay more than what we receive. This is through brain drain, this is to purchasing arms and ammunition. One of the biggest jokes we always talk about India, Air India. Air India announces, because it's owned by the government, we made so many million of rupees profit. Then there will be a small column somewhere, we bought 2 747. So actually we paid much more money than what we made. This is a kind of economic racket, if you want. And again, the two important concepts which has developed recently is the new international economic order and new international communication order. And both US and Western Europe haven't gone along with these things. Now, what does our faith say regarding all these things? One of the things I personally believe, and this comes from my Christian faith, is part of our distribution system is very much attached to the boundary line we have drawn. I don't think God has created this world and drawn a boundary line and has said, if you protect this, all what is produced is yours. I think that concept of land is not there. I think we are, God has given this land for all the people to benefit. So today it so happened historically, US got so much of land, USSR got so much of land, and we are cramped in a small place. that doesn't mean that what is produced on this earth, which is a creation of God, shouldn't go to these people. I think every person who is born has the right to get from God's creation. And the other question you have to raise, how much profit you can make? 200%, 300%, 1000%? There are some medicine which costs hardly 1% and it is sold for 200% profit and things like that. And in most of, in our country, we don't have control to these things. If you don't buy this, you won't be given that. We had, I think, as a symbolic, we said we don't want Coca-Cola. That was a big deal, but we got from other way a lot of other things. This is a kind of... So I think as Christians we have to reflect. I think in the third world now what we are talking about, theology of nature and theology of creation. This is one thing which is studied again and again. This creation, does it belong to powerful? Its might is right, and things like that. Now coming to plowshares, what plowshares is going to do and what is my particular interest? I think one of the things we are interested to bridge the gap and also have the communication flow between our country and your country. And I was surprised, a few months back we had a big consultation on communication, and we found out 80% of the news is controlled by 6 major companies which belong to the affluent world. And they decide what news should go and when it should go and how it should go, and they tamper as much as with the figures as they want. If they are not happy, they will say only 100 people have died, and if they want to give a correct news, they can give it. And most of us get this communication through this 80% channel which is controlled by a small group. And there's a lot of misunderstanding. Many times people come and say, why you are having so much of poverty, why you want to have so many children? And some people say, cattle is going around, why can't you eat that? This is a kind of thing. This is partly because there is a lack of communication. Whereas in my own country, they said, we can't wait for the mercy and sympathy of the first world. They are the cruelest people on earth. But then I say, listen, you see, you are listening only what is happening in Pentagon or what is CIA is doing, not the people. So what we want to do is, you come and see us. What is the problem? Why is the population rising, or why the cattle are not eaten? I think Plowshares and some is the one organization which facilitates. I think this is my primary responsibility with them. In January, a group of people come. We'd like you to meet Indira Gandhi, of course, the president of Non-Aligned Movement. Also, we want you to go and live in villages and hear from them. People won't be put down in Hilton and other places, and you'll also see Mother Teresa and things like that. And people will understand, talking to you, your struggle is as hard as our struggle. It is not so easy. We think US, sometimes people think US is a democracy, they can change the president if they want, or congressman. That's not that easy. And our people will know you are concerned about us, and you are also struggling. Through my own personal experience, I had this kind of visitation experience in four different countries. I was in West Germany for 4 weeks, again involved in mine workers and some Green Party at that time and things like that. East Germany, Philippines and Sri Lanka. And this has opened my eyes, and I see people are common everywhere and struggle, and that's so much common between our struggles. It's only this kind of solidarity and knowing that we are concerned with each other and we have a common goal to change this, I think will bring a change. And I think one of the greatest gifts we have is Jesus Christ himself, through which we have broken many barriers. And that, I think, solidarity, with the solidarity to involve ourselves in the economic and political situation, will bring a change, and I think in that sense there is a great hope.
Thank you. We've had three very powerful statements, and in the short amount of time we've got left, it's very difficult, I'm sure, to to know where to come, but we are clearly open to questions or responses at this point to any one of us.
Yeah. Being an amateur student of history, I am noticing a lot of national commentary, whether it's on the lack of moral righteousness of the United States and many of its involvement, which I agree wholeheartedly with. But that's nothing different than there has been in any time recorded history. It's the same kind of power structure, the same kind of oppression that we've heard about in India, of the haves against the have-nots on a national scale or an international scale. And being an accountant by trade, I'm fairly practical, I guess. And being as a Christian, extremely concerned about the role of the church, well, not the church, of committed Christians, and my own role in this process. And in my own reflection, I really see no real hope for any great change without a tremendous revival, renewal of Christian, truly committed Christian belief, not only in this country, but throughout the maybe first and second level countries. You have tremendous problems of, say, all of the Western countries in the first world having this revival without it affecting the second world. We create a tremendous power imbalance with historical greed, which one country having the ability to create a power structure that could dominate the world, Rome, for instance, it would take, you know, it's 95% of everything. How do you feel as theologians about this? Is there hope in the few, in the very few that are committed and concerned in this country, in Western countries, countries that need to change their whole political outlook, their whole sense of national morality in order to affect this redistribution of the wealth that obviously exists?
Take that one. Is there hope for the flowers?
It's a big order.
I want some realistic hope.
I think churches have to be what somebody's called islands of shalom. We have to at least be these little spots where we're trying to do things in a different way to make that kind of witness, even if it doesn't seem to be paying off immediately. We've got to keep a witness to keep these things you're concerned about alive. I think another thing is we cannot wait until everybody has been made into a Christian to start doing these things. It isn't let's convert individuals and then the society can be changed by converted individuals. There's a concern about personal conversion, but it has to go hand in glove, it seems to me, with building out in the communities, with whatever alliances we can make, the structures that will begin to bring about the change. And partly, the nature of society helps to create new possibilities for Christian love to be expressed, just as the cultivation of Christian love can have its impact on the society. I think that's got to be absolutely a two-way street. And I don't accept for a moment that there's a valid distinction between the people interested in personal conversion and the people interested in the conversion of structures of society. They've got to always be impacting one another. That's one of the biggest fights we have in my denomination. I don't know how it is in the Lutherans, but I think you've got history, some problems, and that kind of thing, too. And we've got to do both of those together. And I think the other thing, just one other thing, I think in the process of the concerns for the justice issues, we have to make alliances with all people who share those concerns. One of the big problems for many of the Latin Americans initially was when they started to get concerned about the poor, they found the Marxists had gotten there first. Are they going to make alliances with the Marxists? Wow, that's a new idea. That's not much of a problem in the United States. We don't have any Marxists floating about. But we've got a lot of people, humanists or people of goodwill and concern, and we've got to work with them and develop
the kind of clout which can mean we can confront our government at a time of an election or something, say, we don't like these policies that are going on, they've got to be changed. Well, this is just three kind of initial responses I'm making.
I would say generally that one thing is the power, the balance of power and the circumstances in which power is exercised has changed in the global village that we live in over against past history. We don't have the luxury of being independent nations and having independent destinies. We're all bound up together. And I think there's important to need, great need to make people aware of that kind of interdependence. And in my experience in just raising money for institutions, I have found that people very often respond to what I would call enlightened self-interest. They give you money for a cause, not because they appreciate what you're doing, but because they're going to get something out of it. And of course, it's negatively. If people know that they are threatened by continuing the procedures which now imperil entire human family, it may be that that would cause them to arrest some of the policies, and that would give us a chance to do something with identity perhaps.
Okay. Okay.
Do
you want to speak to that?
Yeah, I think if you just see the history, there's a lot of hope. Whatever today we are enjoying, this is because of the struggles of many people and others. This can we can very well speak in your own context, the whole the black revolution or black movement. It took years and years of painful struggle and suffering. And whole Indian independence, if you have seen that Gandhi movie, you see, people laughed at him. He said, British Empire, as if they said the sun never used to set. You are going to, such a small person, you are going to shake it. And I think it's a determination, commitment, and I think support from coming to individual is going to help the situation.
I think I want to further quick response, because you were asking for signs of hope and so forth. One of the things that's been most interesting to me in trying to learn a little bit about the Latin American situation, when people like Gutierrez or other theologians we know come up here, they tell us about what's going on, and we say, God, it sounds so awful down there, you get all this repression, I mean, it must be a terrible time. He says, it's the most hopeful time we've ever had. The first time in our history that our people have begun to realize they can take control of their own destiny. Now, there are going to be a lot of tough times, there's probably going to be some bloodshed, it's going to be more repression and so forth, but there's a fantastic hope, because they don't anymore have to say, there's nothing we can do, we just got to accept our lot. They're beginning to find ways to organize, to express their concerns, the church is beginning to work with them. So he said, it's a time of tremendous hope. We need to remember that, and look for the signs of hope in our own situation, to say that there are some ways of making change. So the plea for hope, the call for hope is a very important one.
General affirmation, enthusiastic affirmation. Another issue. We probably have, how, where are we, Larry, in terms of...
5 minutes, yeah.
Okay. Questions, concerns?
Let's
put my glasses on
and
see if I can see
your hand.
Larry.
Well, I hope this isn't too abstract, and maybe we can find a concrete instance. I thought it very helpful, Ellis, in your description of different understandings of human rights. First world, we think in terms of individual human rights, and especially maximizing individual choice guaranteed by law. Second world, communal and social rights. And third world, survival and liberation rights. How is it that you get folks who, when they think human rights, think in that Anglo-American contract terms to start conceiving of human rights in terms of survival rights and communal and social rights?
I think this is very much ties us into what we were doing last night in terms of what are the methodologies, what are the ways of educating those of us to broaden that perspective. Is that what your question is?
Yeah, I don't want to undertake a different... I mean, I don't want to start talking about methods, but I would... Maybe just some examples of, that you know of people who have made that shift, or maybe we draw on some of our own experience. I'm sure Black Americans have something to teach us there.
Well, I think it's the folks like us here, Davis Roberts and here, Henry Wilson. I mean, I think the church has got to be the arena that does the sensitizing there, and it's not that we will start telling the rest of the world what third world people at home or abroad need, but we'll provide the platform on which or through which they can speak for themselves. And one cannot help but become more sensitized if you hear from the victims something about what it means to them to need human rights that we before have only thought of as privileges. It's a pretty large shift of orientation. And it will only come, I think, as we have to confront the people for whom it is, for them, a life and death issue.
Yeah.
Bob, you want to respond to that as well?
Just want to share our experience. Henry has done that, and so is the others. There's Jacques Ellul, whose motto is, the issue is to think globally and act locally. And part of what Henry invites us to do is to share the experience of solidarity, which is also one of suffering, but also of incredible joy and hopefulness. That the two-thirds world also brings with it values and gifts of enormous value. And what we need to do is to get in contact with that. One is the visitation. The second level is to listen to the story, whether they're cases or narratives or deceivings, and to see where that touches you and what the responses must be. And I've seen people's lives turned around at all of those levels to begin to understand what are new ways to think about human rights in the world.
Now, let me share one response by someone who went to East Africa on a seminar and was struggling with what happened to him. And he said he came back from, he always had an image of mission and affluence and what we give. He went into a village and spent a whole weekend, experienced worship, experienced an overwhelming sense of joy, of family, a whole new way of perceiving the Christian gospel, and came back that night utterly shaken, saying, I thought that we were always the ones who were giving. I have had more given to me over this last weekend than I ever imagined. That here was the joy and the essence and an understanding of the Christian faith. And he said, you know, I have been the oppressed. I have been the deprived in my understanding of my faith when I see it in this new light. That we are in an era where we are overwhelmed with technology and advances and communication. Can we use those to communicate? Use those as tremendous gifts rather than as burdens which could oppress us. Yes.
Well, I would like simply to add a small footnote to that, Alice and Bob and all the rest of you. I think that we run the greatest danger in building walls around ourselves and calling that the totality of God's truth. And it just has become ridiculous to make that claim anymore as white, middle-class American Christians. And I can think of two concrete examples to remain in that vein of concreteness. One is my experience at Harvard Divinity School. In that old illusion, the mecca of knowledge and progress and liberalism. However, a place where a majority of the faculty and a lot of the students simply are starving for some indication of the spirit and of life and that which upfills. We have a very small minority of blacks, which for some strange reason, against all reason, I guess, keep coming. And worship experience at Harvard, I would dare say 75-80% of the time is created by that 3% of the student body. Mm-hmm. You know, so where we sit around there, you know, as these who have been trained to restrain tears and to speak only rationally, we're brought to tears by evidence that the spirit is still alive, even there. Now, that's a very small example, but I have seen evidence that on our globe, that's the experience of African Christians. In a church which is just growing enormously, and experience the spirit is very alive, we've got to open our eyes to seeing that we, ESL, learn from those people. But we can do that only if we stop defining Christianity in these very small terms.
I think my hunch is our time is there. We've got information for those who have asked us on Plowshares. There are a couple on the seminar. There's a book. As Bob asked me, since we are down to a few, if you really want one, take it, but don't file it in your round file, the one on the floor, the waste basket. Use that if you really think you will, because we've got just a few, or we'll share them in common. Thank you. Appreciate your